All right, this is the third side of the interview with Larry Finkelstein. And we were talking about the San Francisco conference and Senator Connally. And we were describing some of the anecdotes involving him.
This one is the same meeting, the same occasion, and it has to do with the interpreters. As you can imagine, the mood in that room is extremely tense.
Yeah.
And the tension was so great, it was palpable, you could feel it.
Mm-hmm.
And here was Connally coming to read the Riot Act to this large group of smaller countries to whom the issue was very important. It was a matter of passion, I would say. And Connally stood up, and he began, in effect, by saying, "Here we are, come together in this beautiful city of San Francisco to reach agreement on the United Nations Charter, and wouldn't it be a damn shame if we had to go home without one?"
Mm-hmm.
That was a real tough message, and
yeah.
That's not exactly what he said, but it's close
that,
enough.
Yeah,
it really is the essence of it.
Yeah.
For the conference, they had rounded up interpreters who had worked for the League of Nations and who were very skilled.
Uh-huh.
And in those days, of course, what you had was consecutive interpretation, not simultaneous interpretation.
Mm.
The interpreter would stand with a pad of paper taking some notes as the speaker delivered his remarks, and then afterwards would render them in the other language, which in this case would have been French. So after Connally did this tremendously offensive speech,
mm-hmm.
the interpreter, who was a man called Camancaire, there were two Camancaire brothers
mm-hmm.
from the League of Nations, stood up and started to read it back in French, and he said, "Nous sommes assemblés ici à la belle ville de Chicago." And the room dissolved in laughter. The tension was broken.
Yeah.
And to this day, I don't know whether he did that deliberately or not.
Right.
Well, the conference succeeded. So
yeah.
He made a great contribution.
So he made a contribution. That's great. Well, now, we've been talking about the five great powers. But at the time, who was representing France? Because the war in Europe had just ended right around that time. So,
Well, there were, you know, this was the government of France represented.
Mm-hmm.
De Gaulle was the president.
And
gosh, I should remember. They had some old pre-war diplomats. Those names are all easily available.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, they just don't pop to my head. If I thought about them, probably I could reconstruct them.
But they had
a regular strong delegation.
Uh-huh.
And after the conference started, or at some point late in the proceedings, maybe in the weeks just before the conference, they were added to the great powers.
Uh-huh, right. But it was right shortly before.
The British,
they hadn't really been participating before that, had they?
Yeah. And the British pushed for that. Churchill wanted that. And, you know, with Hull fading in influence, I suppose his resistance probably mattered less. Hull was very angry at the beginning. FDR didn't like De Gaulle.
Mm.
He was a very difficult character.
Mm-hmm.
So relations with the Free French were prickly throughout.
Mm-hmm.
And then De Gaulle earned the hostility of Cordell Hull, who could be a very bitter and powerful enemy, when he undertook the invasion of those two little islands in the North Atlantic, Saint-Pierre and Miquelon, sometime in 1940,
mm-hmm.
late 1940, which represented a direct challenge to the American policy of protecting the Vichy government's rights against chains. I don't remember all the details.
Mm-hmm.
There's a considerable literature on this, if anybody's interested.
Mm-hmm.
But De Gaulle sent a submarine, and they landed troops and ran up the Fleur-de-Lis, the Gaullist colors. And so he had an uphill road gaining anything from the United States thereafter, as long as Hull was in office. And, you know, the truth is, I hope not to be taken offensively, but the truth is that France was not a great power on the scale of Britain or the United States, or especially the USSR and the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Incidentally, you know, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the American Joint Chiefs of Staff, were very perceptive about the post-war power relationships. The record is very clear that by 1944, they were saying, it's us and the Russians.
Yeah.
And you can ignore the Brits, you can ignore the French, you can ignore the Chinese for practical purposes of managing power in the world. And therefore, it is critically important that we get on with the Russians.
Right. Yeah, so they were aware of it.
So there was a disposition against the French, and they were shoehorned in at the late hour. But then they had a delegation. They participated in one of the forums that I alluded to, but should have mentioned more directly, was the continuing five power consultations throughout the conference.
Mm-hmm.
Stettinius chaired meetings of the five powers.
Okay.
Molotov, who was there only for a short time, represented the Russians, but then Gromyko.
Uh-huh.
The Brits, Eden, was there for a while, uh-huh. and then I forget who the head of the British delegation was there after, but the heads of delegations met very regularly to deal with issues of substance and management of the conference.
Uh-huh.
And there was a five-power forum in which they hacked out their proposals on non-self-governing territories and trusteeship.
Uh-huh.
As a precondition for presenting them to the conference as a whole.
Uh-huh.
And then, as I say, afterwards they formed a glacis and defended themselves against external.
Well, how did the issue of the Soviet Union having three representatives arrive?
That had come up earlier. Roosevelt had agreed, I forget whether it was at Yalta or perhaps at Tehran, when he met Stalin in 1943, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
Stalin had requested representation for the 16 republics.
Mm-hmm.
That proposal, which takes on a different perspective in 1990.
Exactly.
And Roosevelt understood that was political, very prickly politically of the United States.
Yeah.
And toyed with the idea of countering with a proposal that the then 48 states of the United States be given membership as well.
Yeah.
But that would have been foolish. And so we reached a compromise agreement to let Belarus and the Ukraine have membership. And this is my personal view now, in 1990, looking back on it. It was not an important issue.
Mm-hmm.
It was understood at the time that it didn't really make much difference, and mm-hmm. it gave them two additional voices. It turns
mm-hmm.
out it took more time in running meetings because you had two other people with the right to speak.
Mm-hmm.
But the voting situation, I think, never proved to make those two votes critical in any sense. It just was a non-issue.
Was there any consideration of that as a trade-off for accepting Argentina?
No, I don't think so. I think Roosevelt's commitment was made, I don't know.
Before that,
I never heard that. Or if I heard it, I've forgotten. I just don't remember.
Also, you've mentioned a couple of times that you had taken the train out to San Francisco from the East Coast. Did many of the participants from all of internationally take the train to San Francisco?
This was wartime, remember.
Yeah.
And transportation was very difficult.
Yeah.
There were several special trains.
Mm-hmm.
And they had to be specially routed because of the demands of wartime transportation. You know, the war in Europe ended, as I recall. No, what happened? The U.S. forces met up with the Russians in Europe on the day the conference started, 25th of April. The war was still going on in 1945.
Okay.
And the May 8th was the end of the European war.
Mm-hmm.
So, and plans were beginning to be made for the conduct of the war in the Pacific, so everything was all knotted up.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
My train, I was told this had never happened before, my train was routed through the yards in Chicago
mm-hmm.
without disembarking, without getting onto another train,
mm-hmm.
and then continued westward on a route that went southwest through St. Louis
mm-hmm.
down to El Paso.
Mm-hmm.
And across the desert to Los Angeles, then up the coast to San Francisco.
And
that was apparently had to be arranged specially because of the difficulty.
Yeah.
I don't remember meeting foreign delegations on that train. There was a large group of Americans, including Bunch and Garrett.
Uh-huh.
Ralph and I shared a compartment.
Oh, really?
And he looked at skinny little me and said, "You take the upper." And a lot of the delegation staff were there. And I you know, I was very junior, very unsophisticated in the ways of the world. I wouldn't have known how to deal with a foreigner anyway. Uh-huh. So they may have been there without my knowing. It was a big train, a long train with dining cars. They treated us well. Then after the conference, I took a special train back, and we went up the coast to Portland, and then up into southern Washington, across North Dakota.
Well, I was just wondering whether or not the taking the train, which took a long time, and you covered all of the United States, would somehow be impressive to foreign delegations as to the size and the diversity of such a vast country.
Well, I'm pretty sure that some delegations, or staffs anyway, did cross the country on the train, and that impression was made. But I didn't get to see them, I guess. I don't know why.
Failing
of mine.
Okay.
But I did say that the U.S. trusteeship plan was cobbled together in that 4 days of the transit.
Yeah, right. So that was an important time. That night. Time, uninterrupted, because you didn't even get phone calls. Well, you've mentioned Ralph Bunche a number of times. How influential was he in San Francisco? Was he a powerful figure at all?
Well, I have very little first-hand basis for answering that, because he was off working on a trusteeship, and I was doing these other things.
Yeah.
And we saw each other from time to time, but basically we were not in very close contact.
Uh-huh.
He was a relatively junior person.
Mm-hmm. At that point.
I don't recall that he ever appeared before the delegation.
Uh-huh.
The representation on those issues generally was handled by Stassen himself.
Mm-hmm.
Although he may have been there from time to time, sitting behind Stassen.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't remember that. I think he was not a major power. I think he was emerging at this time.
Yeah.
He was obviously extremely able and competent, and a good draftsman, a tough, hard negotiator. So that probably he was making his mark then. But the decisions were made by the delegate, the big decisions, the important decisions were made in the delegation, or sometimes, as in that incident of Stassen's position on independence, by the delegates themselves. And I don't think, although I wouldn't be sure of this, I don't think there ever was occasion when the seat in Committee 2-4 was not occupied by Stassen himself.
Mm-hmm.
I noticed later at the first UN General Assembly in London, when the U.S. representative on these matters was John Foster Dulles, he often wasn't there, and so Ralph Bunche got to sit as the representative of the United States in the UN General Assembly Committee dealing with trusteeship and non-self-governing territories matter.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that happened at San Francisco.
Yeah, and how powerful a person was Stettinius? Was he influential?
Stettinius, the two senators were the real powers in the delegation.
Yeah, okay.
And the real force, the intellectual and oratorical force within the delegation meetings was Stassen.
Mm-hmm.
And Stettinius was a pretty pompous, very good-looking, tan, curly white teeth, white hair.
Mm-hmm.
Physically fit, very self-conscious fellow, very insecure.
Mm.
And he was supposed to be the person who talked to the president about these matters.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, as the chairman of the delegation and as the secretary of state, he must have had a considerable influence in helping to shape the president's decisions when issues were being argued when there were splits in the delegation.
Mm-hmm.
So institutionally, he was placed to be a powerful figure, but I had no access to any of that. I have no idea what went on in the conversations between Stettinius and Truman, which happened every day. He was on the phone all the time. So I really have no judgment on that. But most people thought he wasn't very bright. He was kind of slow-witted.
And then later, as you said, Truman named someone else secretary.
After the conference was over. Yes, he obviously did not have great confidence from the president.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you asked much earlier about optimism.
Yes, I know. We'll come back to that.
And
yeah.
I meant to mention this.
Uh-huh.
I have a probably unique view that Stettinius made a tremendous contribution to the success of the conference.
Oh.
Because he was irrepressibly optimistic about it.
Okay.
And during those days when the veto issue, and please don't misunderstand this, the veto issue in my judgment came very close to wrecking the conference. That the disagreement over the extent of the veto between Moscow and the United States was a critical determining issue, and that if the Hopkins mission had not produced a successful outcome,
mm-hmm.
The conference might very well have failed over
mm-hmm.
that issue.
Mm-hmm.
And during those days, the tensions were extreme. I have some letters of mine upstairs reflecting my feelings at the time, that the thing was very chancy, that the thing might just bust up. And during all those days, Stettinius refused to pretend that he believed that.
Mm-hmm.
He kept up a very optimistic patter, and reassurance, the coach patting the players on the back and telling them not to worry, everything was going to come out. And his teeth smiled all over the place,
mm-hmm.
both within the delegation and in the international fora.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that had a very helpful, nobody quite believed it,
mm-hmm.
but still it helped to offset the
yeah.
gloom which otherwise was pervading the place.
Right, right.
And I thought that was an important contribution as well.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I think we could move to some discussion about the Security Council. We've been talking about
sure.
the veto, which takes place in the Security Council, but there was, how much of the structure of the Security Council had been set up ahead of time in Dumbarton Oaks, in terms of the who would be on the Security Council, how many, what kinds of votes would the non-permanent members have, and so forth?
I do believe that essentially the job was done before the conference started.
Mm-hmm.
The membership was fixed at 11. At what point was it decided that there would be 5 veto-wielding powers? As you pointed out earlier, the French were not at Dumbarton Oaks. They didn't get into this and become the 5th member.
Mm-hmm.
So that, now I'm speculating, must have been part of the deal by which it was agreed that they would be admitted to the conference and would come and participate,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Although that was not, I think, in the Dumbarton Oaks text.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I'd have to go back and check, but I assume that the 5 powers agreed on that, got everybody else to agree that there would be 5
mm-hmm.
Permanent members of the Security Council,
yeah, uh-huh.
and those were the ones whose affirmative vote would be necessary to get a decision of substance. The total size of the council was fixed at 11. And as I say, the issue was about how far the veto would extend down the chain of decisions in the direction of the procedural.
Mm-hmm.
And those issues were not resolved
mm-hmm.
at Dumbarton Oaks. And part of the charter, the proposal was left blank
mm-hmm,
at
mm-hmm.
that point, they bracketed.
Right.
And then it was not resolved either altogether at Yalta.
Mm-hmm.
So those questions were finally settled only during the conference.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But as for the rest of it, I think the structure of the Security Council and the general outline of its powers was pretty well established before they got to San Francisco. Now, there were issues. We talked before about self-defense.
Mm-hmm.
Article 51 was not in the Dumbarton Oaks provisions.
Mm-hmm.
That's the one that recognizes that there is a right of individual or collective self-defense if there is an armed attack against a member.
Mm-hmm.
And we also mentioned wrestling over the relationship between the universal and the regional organization.
Right, yeah.
And there was some fussing, too, about the authority of the Security Council in relation to the continuing authority of the victorious powers in the war over the defeated enemy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And there were some provisions that got into the Charter protecting the continuing rights of the occupying powers for peace and security vis-a-vis Germany and Japan.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Before the UN should be given that responsibility.
Yeah.
I don't really remember how far the Dumbarton Oaks discussions had gotten in dealing with those issues. I think probably they were add-on in the conference.
But
basically, I'm pretty confident that, that the essential deals on the Security Council had been struck before. Mm-hmm.
Now, was there some discussion in San Francisco also on the role of the General Assembly versus the role of the Security Council?
Yes, and interestingly, I'm glad you raised that question. Interestingly, in the U.S. delegation, there was strong advocacy of increasing the role of the General Assembly on the part of the Republicans. Vandenberg and John Foster Dulles, who was not a member of the delegation but was there as a senior advisor.
Oh, he was an advisor, all right.
Representing Governor Dewey, with whom he'd been very close, and who was expected to be, as he became, a candidate for the presidency. So, so this was Roosevelt's device for ensuring a collaborative relationship with the leadership of the Republican Party. It wasn't the only device, but it was the main one.
Yeah.
Dulles was there as Dewey's man. And Dulles and Vandenberg. Dulles and Vandenberg were pressing for more authority for the General Assembly. And I think it was Vandenberg, I think it was those two, who also pushed for more emphasis on the concept of justice in the Charter. And some of the times the word justice is in there now, it's directly attributable to Vandenberg's and Dulles's advocacy of it.
Interesting.
It's an interesting point, and it's one which has some contemporary relevance.
Definitely,
What principles are to guide the Security Council? And I think that what they did at Dumbarton Oaks in San Francisco was to create an organ whose important decisions would be determined by the votes. When does the Security Council act? It acts when the five great powers don't cast a veto and when there are enough other votes to constitute the requisite majority for a decision. And that's an important observation because it says that the Security Council was intended to be a political organ, an organ representing the agreement necessary to allow it to succeed, and not an organ guided by principles or criteria of conduct. The critical threshold written into the Charter at the beginning of that Chapter 7 that I referred to before, enforcement powers on, is that there should be a situation threatening, a threat to the peace, a breach of the peace, or an act of aggression. Nowhere does it say that the Security Council must determine that there has been an aggressor. It's entitled to act if peace is threatened, or if an act breaching the peace has occurred. Not only if there's an aggressor. Nor does the Charter anywhere say that the Security Council must act against the aggressor. The Security Council, whenever the votes are there, may conclude that the aggression was justified, that its pressure should be against the country, the victim of aggression, because its policy was a source of disorder that led to the breach of the peace. This is kind of theoretical and abstract, and that hasn't yet happened that I know of. But it's important to understand that this was a political conception of an organ acting on the basis of the necessary agreement, rather than an organ bound to enforce law or impose law or bring about just outcome. And John Foster Dulles particularly was a lawyer. He was a senior lawyer. I guess he'd been the managing partner of Sullivan and Cromwell. But he had also been a prominent lay leader of the Protestant lay organizations in the United States. I think he had been president of the Churches of Christ in America. Is that right? One, a major national lay Protestant organization. And it used to be said of him that John Foster Dulles, who always wore a vest and was a very somber dress, carried a pair of brass knuckles in one pocket and the seven pillars of the church in the other. And so, this notion is of a politically guided, powerful body must have been very difficult for him to accept intellectually, morally, and spiritually.
Mm-hmm.
And so he and Vandenberg were pressing for more references to justice.
Yeah.
And they were put in as adornments, but in ways that I think did not really affect the decision-making or the outcomes in the UN system.
Well, also I had understood that the Latin Americans were pressing for more power to the General Assembly, because that was a larger representative body.
Well, you know, you just think about it, it's almost self-evident that that they would press for power for an organization in which votes had equal influence, as distinguished from the Security Council, in which the great powers had the veto.
Mm-hmm.
What more is there to be said about that? What question were you getting at?
Oh, just the distinction between the General Assembly and the Security Council.
It's interesting. I don't know that much attention was paid to the great power that the General Assembly was given, which was to adopt the budget and to impose assessments on members, to set the assessments for members.
Yeah.
And under the Charter, those are legally binding.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Maybe the one power the General Assembly has to take decisions that bind the member.
Yeah, yeah.
And that has been the source of an enormous growth in the organization, namely combined with the power the General Assembly has by majority vote to adopt a program, to decide what the organization should do, and the power to set the budget. You've had an enormous, real power exerted by the General Assembly.
Okay, so that in the conference itself, when those powers were given to the General Assembly, then the General Assembly was not necessarily conceived of as a weak body.
Well, I don't think people thought about it very much. I think the General Assembly was conceived of as a weak body.
Oh, okay.
That the predominant thought was that the General Assembly was given, except for the one I've mentioned, no powers of decision. Mm-hmm. It could do nothing which would oblige members to obey.
Mm-hmm.
It was therefore thought of, I think it was Vandenberg's term, as the town meeting of the world.
Okay.
A place where people could get up and talk and pass resolutions and express their wishes, but in which nothing important could happen. And my point, the point I was trying to make a minute ago, and I guess I didn't do it very clearly, is that they didn't seriously enough consider the power that would be vested in the General Assembly's capacity by majority vote to adopt programs linked to the power to fix the budget, and the assessment.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
And that has been a real source of strength for the General Assembly. The UNDP, for example, the United Nations Development Program, a whole series of other things, important things, that are done under UN auspices have been done by the General Assembly exercising that power to adopt a program by a majority vote. And that, nobody thought very much about that in San Francisco.
Okay.
They just didn't anticipate it. Well, the whole operational side, the things that the UN does, except for what it was hoped it would do in the peace and security field, everything else the UN does really was not contemplated.
Yeah.
What are the powers given in the human rights field, for example? They're very carefully limited to promoting. The notion was that the General Assembly, the UN, would be an institution in which you could do studies, discuss, adopt resolutions which would not be binding, prepare treaties which would take on their binding quality only through the ratification, acceptance by member states. And none of this was thought to be really the makings of a very powerful organization. And I guess, you know, early on, the UN decided to have a technical assistance program, and then President Truman, in his point four in his inaugural address in 1949, put the United States on record as leading toward the creation of a technical assistance program, and we then, the U.S., pushed for the adoption of technical assistance program in the UN and other bodies throughout the UN system, so that the operational calling of the UN began to develop fairly early in its history.
Yeah.
And it relied on this constitutional power to decide things by majority vote.
Yeah, yeah. Now, was it felt in San Francisco that the economic and social development through the UN, the function of the UN in that capacity, related to peace and security, that would be an important function?
Good point. Let me make an outrageous and probably exaggerated statement. For the U.S., the U.N. was intended to be an organization to maintain peace and security. It was supposed to prevent the recurrence of the kind of aggression mm-hmm. between the wars which had led to World War III.
Yeah.
And yes, you're quite right, the economic and social dimensions of the Charter were viewed by the United States, mm-hmm. not necessarily by all the others, but by the United States, primarily in terms of the peace and security mm-hmm. mission. Economic disorder, poverty were seen as sources of disorder leading to violence. They looked at Germany, you see, the collapse of the German economy, the German inflation
mm-hmm. right.
after World War I.